Hello, and thank you for asking me to do this. My name is Bipasha Barua. I am a professor at the University of Western Ontario in Canada, where I also hold the Canada Research Chair in Global Women's Issues. Before this appointment, I taught in California at California State University, Long Beach. And approximately 10 years ago, if I remember right, in 2009, I was asked to give a lecture at the Los Angeles Geographical Society. They had asked me to give a lecture on contemporary India. At the time, there had been a very popular film called Slumdog Millionaire. And so I called my lecture at the time Slumdogs and Millionaires: Understanding Contemporary India. So when I was asked to give this particular lecture in 2019, I thought it would be a chance for me to update the lecture by about 10 years. And I chose the title Slumdogs and Billionaires: Understanding Contemporary India. So what I'll do in the next 45 minutes to an hour is try to walk you through some of the most kind of popular tropes about India and try to tell you something hopefully that will add to your learning about contemporary India. So I'm not sure how much background to provide about India in sort of like recent historical context. So what I'll do is start with this little multiple choice question, as it were. A lot of my undergraduate students in Canada are very fond of multiple choice. But if you were asked, India is A, a mostly agrarian, poverty-stricken country; B, a world leader in information technology, pharmaceuticals, and space exploration; C, the country with the third largest number of HIV positive people in the world; D, a country with one of the largest middle class populations in the world; and E, all of the above. I've had people choose a variety of responses to this question. I have a feeling that you are going to choose E, and that would be the correct response. India is all of the above. And that is what I think makes teaching contemporary India sometimes quite challenging, because it's very difficult to say anything definitively about India, because you're always bound to find exceptions. If something is true in one part of India, it's absolutely not true in another part of India. So what I'll do is, like I said, is walk you through some of the most popular tropes about India and see how they're all of it is basically a paradox of simultaneity, right? So we have simultaneously very paradoxical things happening in India. So take you back just a little bit in time. If I take you back to the post-independence era, India became independent from the British in 1947, at which point India and Pakistan were carved out rather hastily, I have to say, to clean up the mess of colonialism. And Pakistan, declared itself to be very much a state with Islam as a state religion, whereas India chose very explicitly to be a secular country. Granted, it had a majority of Hindus in it, but there were always religious minorities who've been part of India's history. So initially, the country chose to be a socialist democracy. So in a sense, we rejected both the major power structures in the world at the time. We rejected being kind of a first world, kind of like a market economy, as it were. We also rejected the Soviet model, which is a centrally planned economies, and we chose much more along the lines of the third way, which is where the world third world actually comes from, is to be a socialist democracy. So what this meant was that there were very strict government controls over private sector, over foreign trade, and over foreign direct investment in India. We had what was called import substitution, which meant that we didn't want imports flooding the Indian market. Instead, we wanted to give Indian industries a chance to grow and develop and perfect themselves, improve their production techniques, to basically stand alone. So we, instead of importing stuff, we decided that we would develop those goods and products ourselves. Try to substitute what might be coming in as imports. That's what's called import substitution. And we had a state-led model of industrialization with interventions in labor and financial markets. That's a very clear, those are very clear hallmarks of this era of socialist democracy. And then from at the time, okay, I forget to mention this, The rate of growth, economic growth, was so slow that there was a term developed pejoratively. So it's a pejoratively, India's economy was, referred to as the Hindu rate of growth, which means that our population is growing significantly faster than our economy. So it was meant to be a pejorative sort of term. Then from 1980 to 1990, I would say slowly we're starting to see more pro-business measures being introduced, first by Prime Minister Indira Gandhi, and then by her son Rajiv Gandhi, who was also Prime Minister. Over time, we're starting to see, the removal of things like price controls, and we're starting to see corporate taxes coming down to encourage more investment in India. Then, to take us to the sort of the more contemporary era, which would be 1990 to present, we start to see things like economic liberalization, which was first incepted by Prime Minister P.V. Narasimha Rao and Minister of Finance Dr. Manmohan Singh, who eventually, of course, went on to also be India's Prime Minister. During this era, we see a lot of the kind of the hallmarks of what happens when public monopolies open. So different sectors are opened up for investment by the private sector, for example. So those of us, for example, who remember flying on Indian Airlines, which was the Indian airline when we were, which was the only airline, it was the state airline when I was growing up, for example, in the 1980s, and having to put up sometimes with fairly bad service because it was a state-run airline. And then, fast forward to about the 90s, where there was just incredible private investment in the airline industry, and all of a sudden we're spoiled for choice in terms of having so many private carriers. And it also ironically motivates Indian Airlines to pull up its socks and to become a far more efficient airline with better customer service, for example. I remember that distinctly. I remember being very surprised in about the mid to late 90s, going back to India and traveling Air India, Indian Airlines rather, and being quite blown away by the customer service and thinking, oh, well, okay, this is one of the positives of the elimination of public monopolies. There was also approval of foreign direct investment, which means that foreign corporations could compete with and could enter the Indian market in very large numbers. And since then, I would say that since 1990 to the present time, give or take some differences, I would say that the overall direction of the economy has remained the same, regardless of the political party that has been in power since then. One very interesting exercise is for me to look at books that have been published about contemporary India, say in the past, I would say 10 or 15 years, and to look at their titles. So, for example, you have, India Express, The Future of a New Superpower by Daniel Lack, who was a BBC journalist, and all of them, or you have Shashi Tharoor's book, The Elephant, The Tiger, and The Cell Phone. What I find interesting is that all of them try to convey the idea that India is a country of tradition and history, but also of modernity. So there, it's always those tropes of having the Ganesha, who is the multi-handed, the elephant god of prosperity, but he's always holding a cell phone while also holding sort of like other more traditional objects that you would see in, being associated with the Hindu god Ganesha. Edward Luce's book, In Spite of the Gods, The Strange Rise of Modern India, which was the initial title, got a lot of criticism because people said, what's strange about it? India was, a superpower in the past. It was a very powerful country economically, culturally. So this is just, it's taking back its the position it was intended to take. So in the second edition of the book, I remember that Edward Luce actually took out the word strange. So the book just the title was just In Spite of the Gods, The Rise of Modern India. It's an interesting exercise to look at book titles that have emerged about India in the past. There are many others that you could look up in the past, I would say, 15 to 20 years. And since then, I would say that India has emerged as one of the most, as one of the wealthiest economies in the global South. And we have commenced, I would say, corresponding but not commensurate improvements in things like life expectancy, literacy, and food security. So a lot has improved, I would say, dramatically, but obviously there's also a lot more to go in the future. So moving on, speaking above the first trope about India that everyone has a comment on one way or another is India's population. So I picked, as you can see, the most alarmist tropes about India's population. The first one is from, I think, about 10 years ago, 12 years ago. All these fish crammed into a fishbowl, and they're like, help, we're nearly out of space. And you have the Pac-Man that is literally consuming India because, you know, we're apparently so heavily populated. So let me just put that into context for you to explain why that might be more alarmist than anything else and why it might actually represent an incredible opportunity for India. So yes, at current count, we have about 1.37 billion people, which makes India the world's second most populous country after China. And we're actually projected to exceed China's population by about 2050, China having chosen those very draconian one-child policies for several decades, which they've now relaxed to a two-child policy. But even so, that had a very dramatic impact on China's population that India could obviously never introduce policies like that. And thank goodness for that. It was always a much more soft message about family control, family planning. So growing up, I remember that, like many middle class, upper middle class Indians, I have an older brother. So there's just two of us. And I didn't actually think it was possible for people to have, for families to have more than two children, because the two-child family was absolutely the norm in India. So I didn't think that was even possible for people to have more than two children, essentially, in middle class families. So they had, but that was done very in a very soft way. It was done through kind of family planning. The media was messaging things that led us to believe that having two children was ideal. It was the ideal family, was the family with two children. There was even a slogan called "Hum Do Hamare Do," which literally translates into "We two, our two." Right. So basically, encouraging people to have to go by a two-child family norm. So today, India represents about 17.75% of the world's population. No joking matter. Now, India's demographic dividend, this is where it's very interesting. 50% of our population is below the age of 25, and more than 65% of the population is below the age of 35. So we're talking about essentially a very ancient civilization and country, but we're talking about a very youthful nation. So the first thing that comes to mind is that this means that the lack of a producing and consuming population is not a concern in India. We have plenty of people to produce and plenty of people to consume for the country. This translates into the fact that the dependency ratio of India is very low, and that's a good thing. You know, the dependency ratio is the ratio of people, essentially the ratio between the producing population, so people aged between 15 and 64, and the population that is tends to be more dependent, so over 65 and people below the age of 15. And the lower the dependency ratio, the better it is for a country, because it means that you're not going to have trouble producing for the future, and you're not going to have trouble supporting populations that are more dependent, provided, of course, we have everything working, things like healthcare, education, employment, provided that those things are in place, it's not a problem. And you know, many countries currently face a demographic crisis, as I'm sure you're quite aware. So comparatively, India definitely does not face that crisis. In 2020, for example, the next year, essentially right now, the average age of an Indian is 29 years compared to 37 for China and 48 for Japan. So that gives you a sense of kind of the advantage that India has when it comes to population. There have also been very dramatic drops in death rates and fertility rates. And I'll show you what the fertility rates have been like the past few decades. So if you look at total fertility rates on this chart, going all the way back from 1960 to through, you know, about 1980, year 2000, year 2020, and then what is projected for 2040, what we're seeing is that there has been a really, really dramatic drop in fertility rates. So per woman, we're looking for India at something just below six to at the present time, we're looking at a rate that is just above replacement. 2.1 children per woman tends to be the replacement rate, which means that your population neither grows nor shrinks when you're at that level. So for India, we're looking at just above that right now, about 2.2. And in by about 2040, we're definitely looking at that number going down to two, or actually below two, which is below replacement. Of course, it's important to remember that people are also living much longer. So with life expectancy now well into moving into the 70s, that means that the population will continue to grow, because although people are on average having way fewer children, they're also living longer. So we're still going to see a growth in population, with India expected to overtake China in the next, in the next couple of decades, I think in the next 30 or 40 years. So we do have 1.37 billion people, and that poses incredible both opportunities and constraints. So there is a tremendous opportunity in not having a demographic crisis, but it also means that we have to talk about development for 1 billion people, which is not a joking matter. So when I did this 10 years ago, I called it exactly this: to have and to have not, wealth and poverty in the new India. And today what we're seeing is that poverty has been reduced quite dramatically. So by some accounts, about 30 million people escape poverty in India every year. They're no longer below the poverty line, but there's still a dramatic number that are below the poverty line, and people who really do need improvements in their standards of living. So we can't sugarcoat that. I think it's really important to say that this is a country with the world's largest number of poor people at this point, right? But there's also dramatic wealth. As you can see, the city of Mumbai, when you look at the skylines, this is very much an iconic image now of India, where you see, essentially skyscrapers, and all these sort of symbols of middle class and upper class consumption, alongside what you see is, slums, informal settlements, people living even in rural areas in very, very poor conditions. And I always say that it's important to be completely upfront that these two, the rich and the poor, are mutually constitutive, right? So the rich, it's wealth that not just, wealth actually produces poverty. I think it produces inequality. So I think that is a major challenge. And it's poor people who, through their very low wages, their precarious work, are essentially subsidizing rich people. So I think that getting taxation right, getting corporations to pay the right amount of taxes, getting things like universal basic security, universal basic income correct, are very important features that we have to pay attention to in the future. So when you look at India's wealth pyramid, it's really quite striking, because 92% of Indian adults have wealth of less than $10,000. But then as you move up, you kind of see also the difference between what the wealth pyramid looks like for India and what it looks like for China. So you can see, for example, that extreme wealth, yes, there are 760 people apparently in India who have more than 100 million of personal wealth. And then you have this sizable number of, 50 million to 100 million who also have extreme wealth. But then when you look at this pyramid, you kind of realize that most people, we're still talking about, essentially 92.3% of the population who have assets and wealth of less than $10,000. So comparatively with China, where you can see the letters in white, is India more unequal? In some ways, yes, I would say it is more unequal than China, right? And how is wealth distributed among Indians? If we look at the percentage of wealth owned by millionaires, which is a good indicator, in the world average is that 35% of the world's wealth is owned by millionaires, which is pretty disturbing, and I think it's growing everywhere in the world. Even in Nordic countries, so for example, you see, inequality growing, albeit kind of perhaps less dramatically. So compared to Russia, Saudi Arabia, Nigeria, and Brazil, India doesn't do too badly, but we're still talking about a country where 45% of all wealth is owned by millionaires. In a country of 1.37 billion people, I think it's very important that we pay attention to inequality. So what do you have when you have that kind of inequality? Well, you have luxury resorts, you have 7-star hotels. That's the first time, I remember being in India and somebody saying, "Are you staying in a, next time you should try a 7-star hotel." And I kind of remember saying, I didn't realize that there was anything higher than a 5-star. So apparently there are also 7-star hotels in India. So we're talking about extremes of wealth. This, what you're looking at, is the world's most expensive private home, and it's owned by Mukesh Ambani, who is an industrialist in India, family money made through oil and gas and petrochemicals, regularly lists on the Forbes list of billionaires as, I can't remember, the ninth or the tenth wealthiest person in the world. And this is his private home. As you can see, it has everything from helicopter landing pads to immense car garages for all his luxury cars. So we see this kind of inequality emerge in India, and it's actually very visceral. I mean, I feel it very, very viscerally when I'm in India, in terms of being, meeting up with people, often people who I even grew up with, who were very privileged. They were already well educated. They came from well-to-do families who acquired immense wealth while growing up. I have a friend who retired by the time she was 30 because she had made all this money selling her tech startup for millions of dollars. And I had barely begun my career because I have a PhD, so definitely hadn't begun my career at barely begun my career at 30. So to give you a sense of what we were talking about at this point, you have a huge wine growing industry now. So Sula, for example, is an Indian wine brand that enjoys, increasingly global attention, and you can go and stay on wineries and wine resorts. So there is kind of, for wealthy people, I would say that there are lifestyles that are commensurate with, if not, frankly, I would say they're more opulent, far more opulent than what people enjoy in North America or Europe. We also, of course, have 88%, I think the last I checked, almost 90% of India's population works in the informal sector, often working extremely precarious manual labor. These are pictures from my field work of informal sector women in Gujarat, women who work as garbage collectors, women who work on salt pans for next to no money at all. And I think these are issues that we need to really pay attention to. And one thing that I am personally a major proponent of are universal basic income schemes, as well as universal social protection schemes. I think they work very well everywhere in the world, including in Finland. I know that you had one for, I think, a couple of years ago. I think the pilot just ended last year, and the amounts were very small. People were getting about 500 euros a month, but it made a dramatic difference to their well-being. It reduced stress. It improved people's, perceptions of the future. So I think that as more countries, and I don't just mean industrialized countries, as more emerging economies and even developing countries are progressing towards welfare states, it's really important that we expand such schemes. And I think that's a very meaningful way of reducing poverty, is to have universal basic income schemes. India has piloted one, and I really hope that it will be, replicated and expanded in the future. We see an alarming trend of farm suicides. So at this point, there have been about, in this 20-year period, as you can see, more than 300,000 farmers committing suicide, dying by suicide. And I think this is, again, it's a very disturbing and alarming trend, but it's also understandable because a lot of work in primary economies, for example, working in agriculture, it's not capable of producing the types of livelihoods that people need to make to live meaningfully well, which is why we see very high levels of distress among farmers. As a result of the opening up of the economy, as a result of more neoliberal economic policy, what we also see is that the supports that extended for farmers in the past, for example, no longer exist. So they're having to buy all kinds of inputs into their agricultural processes, dealing with the effects of climate change. So farms are not as productive. Farm sizes are becoming smaller. So all of those, I think, have contributed to immense stress among the farming populations. And it's really important to remember that no matter how sophisticated our IT sector becomes or our space exploration sector becomes, India is primarily an agricultural country. So I think we really need more redistributive policies to ensure that our farmers have good livelihoods, and that farming isn't always kind of the option of last resort, which is what it's becoming increasingly, that people no longer want to be in farming because they know, and by that I mean obviously family farming. I'm not talking about commercial farming, of which there is quite a lot of, because they don't see it as a meaningful livelihood. I think there needs to be almost a global revalorization of these industries that we all need to survive. And I mean that globally. I don't just mean in India. I think we need a revalorization of agriculture everywhere in the world, and more meaningful redistribution to make it a worthwhile livelihood. So moving on to environmental issues, as you can imagine, population of 1.37 billion, a growing population, increasingly middle class population that is starting to consume at rates that are perhaps not commensurate with industrialized countries, but increasingly starting to consume at higher levels, we are beginning to see all of the issues that you can expect. With, you've all heard the stories recently of New Delhi practically having to shut down for a couple of days this winter because the levels of air pollution were just so were so in, so high. So we're seeing problems: air pollution, water pollution, immense depletion of groundwater, which is also very, very alarming. Climate change, I mean, the effects it'll have upon a country with an immense and long coastline with very vulnerable populations. We're already seeing some of this becoming more frequent. We are seeing climate events becoming more frequent. More challenges in the forms of more basic things: a growing population, a growing consuming population, garbage disposal, sanitation, the use of plastics, which actually some states in India have responded very well to by banning, for example, single-use plastics. India is a country of immense biodiversity, and of course, we see tremendous challenges in that regard as well. We see tremendous challenges with energy use and consumption. This is a country that needs and is demanding more energy use and consumption, and we need better solutions to ensure that people have access to clean and renewable energy. We are seeing some interesting, I would say, developments in this regard because we're beginning to see, for example, the expansion of distributed renewable energy, off-grid solutions for meeting energy access. We're seeing incredible creativity, incredible innovation to expanding technologies in renewable energy. There is that conversation about leapfrogging that I'm sure you may have heard of, that there are many parts of the world, including parts of India, remote parts of India, where people now have access to the grid, or most people do have access to the grid, but there is still the need for support from clean and decentralized energy sources. So there's an opportunity for people to leapfrog from not having access to energy to having access to energy through clean and renewable energy sources, much like the telephone revolution, where people in India, it was a very unusual for a family to have a landline. I remember when I was very little. I remember in the 1970s, my father was in the Indian Administrative Service, so we actually had a landline at home. And I remember it was something that the entire neighborhood often came to our house to make phone calls because we actually had a landline. And when we fast forward now, of course, because of the cell phone revolution, you'd be hard pressed to find people who do not have a cell phone in India. So it's become something that we've leapfrogged from having kind of very poor access to landlines to having cell phones. And I think in that context, we do see immense potential for things like renewable energy for that reason, for people who haven't had access in the past. So the way I talk about this is to say that in India, you really see that trilemma that we talk about, the trilemma of how do we build economic security for an enormous group of people, 1.37 billion? How do we protect the environment simultaneously? And how do we ensure that inequality doesn't worsen? How do we ensure that we have equity in various forms, gender equity, equity along the lines of disability, of ethnic minorities, which is a huge issue in India? So how do we pay attention to this, our trilemma of economy, environment, and equity? And I think that India is obviously the biggest test case in terms of how we can move us forward. And I think how what India does with these issues presents lessons for pretty much not just other countries, other emerging economies or developing countries, but I think for the rest of the world as well. One thing that also India specializes in is I would say that it is a country that has always, it's a country, it's a culture that has always known how to turn threats to opportunities. So we see a very strong culture of things like improvisation and innovation in India. So we have, I could talk, I mean, there's a whole culture in India of the term jugaad, J-U-G-A-A-D, which literally translates into improvisation. If you don't have something, you figure out how to improvise, right? That's always been something that India has excelled in. So it's very interesting for me now to see in countries in the West, to see in industrialized countries. Canada, for example, now has some university programs in what is called improvisation studies. So they're trying to improve, innovation studies and improvisation studies. I mean, if you're interested in improvisation, India is the country to go to because you really see examples of improvisation and innovation everywhere. Indians love technology. If a technology works for them, they know how to make it theirs, but they make it theirs in very, very unique ways. So you will see the use of technologies in ways that you haven't seen in other parts of the world, used in very creative and improvised ways. So I think that presents a real opportunity for India. But speaking more broadly about if you look at, for example, this chart that I present, where we're looking at in the future, what are we looking at? We're looking at sort of the sources of energy in India, of power capacity, and we're seeing various technologies. When we look at coal, like going from it being 54% to seeing this major drop in coal, and then you see a slight rise again in 2018, and I see some of that is clean coal. But what we're seeing is definitely a gradual progression towards the growth of renewable energy. And I would say that that is excellent. It's something that we really need to encourage. It doesn't compare as well to China when you look at renewable energy in India, but I would still say that it's dramatic in terms of the capacity that is added every year to renewable energy. And it makes sense, right? It is a country that has tremendous solar energy, it has wind, it has geothermal, it has pretty much all of the new technologies that you can imagine, that promise to lead the way in the future. Talking about another trope that I think gets a lot of attention in India, perhaps not so much today in 2019. When I was giving this lecture in 2009, it was definitely the story about the AIDS story in India was circulating. It was, talked about as being a time bomb that would eventually explode and we would have, this enormous public crisis on our hands. Well, it didn't quite pan out that way. In fact, what we have is a story of, I think, remarkable success in terms of being able to address the AIDS, what was back then called an epidemic in India. So when we look at 2017, India is still the country with the third largest population of people with AIDS, but who are HIV positive, rather, people living with HIV. So in 2017, we were talking about 2.1 million people. Prevalence rates are much lower than they used to be. AIDS-related death rates are much lower. And the expansion of access to antiretrovirals has been kind of a very promising story in India that I feel like I need to share in a little bit more detail. So if you look at this chart, for example, of new infections in India that were estimated between 1998 and 2015, you see that for the most part, it's a good news story. So we see very high levels of prevalence in the late 90s to a very, very, clear decline in both adults and children, presenting with as HIV positive. So this is a good news story. How did India do it? I think I'm summarizing, of course, but this is the story. So many of you may have seen this campaign. It's called We All Have AIDS If One of Us Does. And a lot of famous people, you have, obviously celebrities, you have Elizabeth Taylor and Will Smith and Elton John, Whoopi Goldberg. You have many famous artists lending their name to this. You also have to this campaign, you also have, Nelson Mandela, Desmond Tutu. So again, people who we would consider kind of political or moral leaders also leading. Right in the middle there, you see a woman in a sari. Her name is Dr. Sunichi Solomon. She passed away a few years ago, but she was a tireless advocate for HIV/AIDS in India. And she's included in the campaign for that reason because of her activism. And campaigns like these, I think, made a big difference in India, as did grassroots awareness campaigns about HIV/AIDS. So, on the other hand, there are real structural amplifiers in India, right? We talk about a country that has high levels of poverty, high levels of non-literacy, broadly speaking, low status of women, although that again can be highly variable. We have a large and unregulated sex industry, fairly porous boundaries, at least until now, with other parts of South Asia. Widespread rural and urban migration. We have high levels of urban infrastructure development. So, for example, something as positive as, the highway development on the southwest of India. So if you talk about the states of Gujarat, Maharashtra, and then Karnataka, that corridor, I remember looking at studies that said that that is one of the major corridors for HIV/AIDS prevalence, because we're seeing goods being moved. We are seeing truckers spending, months away from home on the road, and we're seeing a sex industry that is kind of growing around it. So sometimes infrastructure development can lead to an increase in infection rates for HIV, which is very important and then to consider. And I think then you simultaneously have social stigma and cultural impediments about being able to talk about HIV/AIDS. So I think public awareness campaigns of the kind that existed in South Africa, for example, where Nelson Mandela was seen going to be tested. Desmond Tutu was on television. He was shown going to be tested for HIV. I think these are really important because it tells people that this can happen to anyone. It's not shouldn't be a source of shame. And I think those kinds of campaigns worked very well in India as well, which is why we see that it's largely a success story in terms of being able to reduce rates of prevalence of new infections, as well as being able to expand exposure to expand rather access to antiretroviral people drugs for people who are living with who are indeed HIV positive. The other thing, story that a lot of people are not aware of is Cipla, which is an Indian pharmaceutical company, is the world's largest manufacturer of antiretroviral drugs. What they did was took three different drugs that were produced and that were patented separately by these big pharmaceutical companies, by big pharmaceutical companies. They basically combined it as one generic drug called Triimmune, which reduced the cost of treatment from something like $15,000 per person back in the late 90s, down to approximately, $60. I remember when I last looked at it in 2010. My best guess is that it's even lower right now. I wasn't able to find the price for 2019, but my guess is that it's lower than $60, which even $60 is remarkable as the cost of treatment for someone, annual cost of treatment. So this is a pharmaceutical company that is actually now producing antiretrovirals for most countries in quote unquote the global south. And Big Pharma, it was one of those big defeats of Big Pharma, despite all the access they have to drug, to all the access they have to advertising money, to just research and advocacy funds. They finally said, okay, in this particular instance, we do have to. Actually, it was it was mandated at the time that Cipla could produce, that could continue producing Triimmune, because it was a life-saving drug that, was literally saving millions of lives, not just in India, but in other parts of Asia, in other parts of South America, and in of course, parts of Sub-Saharan Africa as well. So I would say that a combination of things like access to antiretroviral drugs, to very inexpensive antiretroviral drugs, as well as incredible success of public education campaigns and grassroots awareness, have been extremely successful in raising awareness and reducing the incidence of HIV/AIDS, not just in India, but I would say around the world. So this is a success story. It's nice to be able to share good news in some instances. So moving on to the question about Indian languages. I mean, how often have I been asked if I speak Indian? Well, I know I don't, because it's not a language. But when we look at India, we kind of understand why this is a country where, in a sense, everyone is a minority, right? So we do have, a large number of people speaking Hindi. Yes, 551 million people. But there are sizable numbers for the other languages as well. We have 22 official languages, as well as many, many, many dialects, thousands of dialects of those languages. And English is a very interesting story, because today India has, if not the one of the most, the largest speaking English populations in the world. Actually, I think it is the largest English speaking population in the world. And this is obviously a bequest of, it is obviously a legacy of colonialism, because you spend hundreds of years in a country and you force a language down people's throats. Eventually, obviously, we're going to speak it well, if not better than the English. So this is English is a very interesting story in India, and today it is an official language. It is also very much an Indian language, counted as an Indian language. It's the old story. I call it kind of the Empire Strikes Back, essentially, right? Like when you teach people a language over hundreds of years, eventually they are going to deploy it to tell their own stories, and they might even deploy it to they might even deploy it against you. So be aware of that. And when we look at the number of Booker Prize winners, English literature in Indian literature in English is huge today. It's a huge seller, and so it's a very interesting story. But we do have we're talking about a country that is linguistically extremely diverse, and it's not unusual for Indians to be multilingual, to speak four or five fluently, because in school we have often if you're middle class or upper middle class, you've had English as a first language, and then you have your mother tongue. In my case, I'm from Assam, so Assamese, and then a third language as well. So in my case, that was Hindi, and then of course we also might study French or Spanish once we are a bit older in middle school or in high school. So it tends to be that is a huge advantage. Being multilingual is a huge advantage that most Indians have. Indian politics gets a lot of attention. I feel as if India is very poorly understood as a democratic country. So I would definitely want to say a few things on Indian politics. How many of you have heard the narrative about Indian exceptionalism? They said it's something very exceptional about India because countries that large usually don't become democracies, right? They choose some form of authoritarian rule. Well, India didn't. It chose to be a democracy upon independence. What does that mean for us? It means that we have 900 million eligible voters in India. That's the size of the electorate. And remember, many of these voters are non-literate or semi-literate, which is why you have on the slide, you can see the sign that says, what is an election symbol? And I'm showing you symbols from different parties in India. So the hand is Congress, the lotus is BJP, the sickle and hammer is obviously the Communist Party of India, Marxist. And many others. Those are all the symbols of different political parties. Because of a large part of the electorate being not literate, people identify who they're voting for by symbols as much as by names and by their slogans. So election symbols are really important in this context. Of that electorate, we have 432 million women who are eligible to vote. Why are the number of women? Clearly, there are more male voters than men. And that it, I'll talk about demographics a little bit later. Yes, our demographic, in that sense, our demographic ratios are completely skewed because of the low status of women and the discrimination experienced by women. Talk about that in a moment. We have what does it take to hold an election? So earlier in 2019, well, 1.35 million polling booths across India. That's what it takes to do the job. How many people work at election booths? Well, 11 million election personnel were deployed to conduct the polls in 2019. There were 83 million new voters, people who were 18 years old and able to vote for the first time. There were 15 million voters aged between 18 and 19. There were 38,000 voters registered from the transgender community. I found this very interesting because a lot of transgender issues are getting attention in India. With the Supreme Court recently striking down, for example, homosexuality as a crime earlier last year in 2018. So I think we're seeing a lot of people, sort of a lot of these issues that didn't get much attention in the past, we are seeing greater visibility in the public domain, which is very encouraging. It's a multi-party democracy like no other. We really do have a lot of powerful parties. There are 2,293 registered political parties. Of course, the Congress, which was the party that led India to independence and formed its first government for the long time. The BJP, the Bharatiya Janata Party, which rules right now. We have powerful regional parties, as well as a very unique feature, our democratically elected communist state governments, particularly the states of West Bengal and Kerala, have since independence had. For a large part of those states' existence since 1947, we've seen democratically elected communist parties. Not always, but for large stretches of time. So this is the most important feature, and this is why India gets a lot of attention in anything to do with studies of democracies. is what is exceptional about India and very different is that the lower the income, the education, and the caste of a person, the higher the odds that the person will vote in elections. This is completely in contrast to US and American trends, where higher voting is always or often always associated with higher income and education. So it's a very interesting and Indian it's a very interesting and Indian twist in politics that we have that people who tend to be less educated and lower income, poorer people, tend to vote. Sometimes I think it's because they feel as if that is the one tool they have to their resource, at their disposal is voting, being able to be heard. So we see very high levels of participation among lower income and sort of lower status, in a sense, social status voters. So what does it take to hold an election like this? Well, as you can see, the general election for 2019, there were seven phases. It took seven phases to host this election. Right? So it began on the 11th of April and didn't wrap up until the 19th of May. So unlike, the US, where elections are held on November 6th, it's over in one day. We definitely can't do that with a country that is as linguistically and geographically diverse as India. In 2019, generally speaking, the BJP, as with the rest of the world, the BJP is a right-wing nationalist party. We've seen them everywhere in the world at this point. And we've seen a resurgent popularity around the world, including, I mean, the True Finns get a lot of traction in Finland, which always really surprises me. In India, we have the BJP doing extremely well at this point in time. Yes, the Indian National Congress is also disappointing to me, for me, because I think that they have held on to dynastic politics for very long. And I really think they're in need of new leadership. But whether we like it or not, the BJP won resoundingly in 2019. So you've all probably heard that India is facing a constitutional crisis at the present time. I felt like it was important to give you some perspective on what's happening in India at the moment. So you've probably heard that India has introduced something called a National Register of Citizens. What is a National Register of Citizens? It's basically a list of people who can prove that they came to India before the 24th of March, 1971, a day before neighboring Bangladesh became an independent country. Now, if you go back to pre-independence and remember that in 1947, when India was partitioned into Bangladesh, into Pakistan and India, now remember, Bangladesh is to the east of India and Pakistan is to the west of India. Bangladesh was at that time part of Pakistan. It was called East Pakistan. And remember that at this time, when the British were departing India, they departed very hastily. So they drew the borders very carelessly and very hastily. And Pakistan chose to define itself along religious lines. It chose to be an Islamic country, a Muslim country. India definitely never chose to be defined in religious terms. It's not a Hindu country. It is not a Muslim country. It is a secular country that welcomes all, religious majorities and minorities. So the National Register of Citizens was introduced by the BJP government with the intention of every Indian now needing to prove that they have basically that, that they being able to claim that they have a connection to India and deserve Indian citizenship. In other words, that they came to India before this particular date in 1971. Now, simultaneously, or actually soon after, not simultaneously, the National Register of Citizens was introduced. The Citizenship Amendment Act was also passed by the Indian Parliament, by the BJP. And this provides citizenship to Hindu, Sikh, Buddhist, Jain, Parsi, and Christian religious minorities from Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Afghanistan. Now, note that it does not include Muslims. In other words, what this does is that what the CAA does, and the two are closely linked, so we have to understand the two together, the CAA and the NRC. So what the CAA does is it protects non-Muslims who are excluded from the NRC, i.e., when there are people who can't show that they have a claim to India before 1971, will still be able to be included as Indian citizens based on the Citizenship Amendment Act, right? This means that tens of thousands of Bengali Hindu migrants, for example, who were not included in the National Register of Citizens, can still get Indian citizenship, right? So if we take these two together, if we take the National Register of Citizens and the CAA together, what it means is that it's a game of double jeopardy against Muslims. So it's an effort by the BJP government to marginalize Muslims even more than they have already been in India, and to turn India into essentially a country with a Hindu majority, or definitely more of like a Hindu nationalist state, which is unfortunately what the BJP is. And we've certainly seen the rise of right-wing nationalist politics all over the world. So this is the Indian manifestation of that particular phenomenon at the moment. This is particularly painful, I think. This whole crisis is painful because this Amendment Act, the CAA, is exclusionary and it violates secular principles that are enshrined in the Indian Constitution, which very clearly states that faith cannot be made a condition of Indian citizenship, right? But the BJP insists on making faith a condition of Indian citizenship. The Constitution of India, in fact, prohibits religious discrimination against any citizens and guarantees people, all people, regardless of faith, equality before the law and equal protection of the law. So it's very painful. It hits particularly close to home because the National Register of Citizens was, initially it was implemented in the state of Assam, which is where I am from, and which has always had a porous boundary with Bangladesh. And a lot of people who came to India via that route before or after 1971. So my hope really is that if I were asked to do this lecture again in 10 years, 5 years, 10 years, I'm really hoping that we can look back upon this and say that this was a terrible chapter that tested the secular nature of India, but failed to defeat the secular nature of India. So I really hope that in 10 years and 5 years, we'd be able to look back upon this as a terrible moment in Indian history, that India was sufficiently resilient enough and secular enough to defeat. Status of women, again, this is something that gets a lot of attention. A lot of people ask you questions about women in India. Often they are remarkably ignorant questions in the West, of course. So questions about it's always about women lacking choice, women lacking agency. So again, it is a story that is kind of a paradox of simultaneity because the status of women in India is actually far, far more complicated. Women's status and their relative well-being really varies dramatically across region, across state, across caste, religion, class, and age. So that's the first off, I need to say that. We have an extremely strong and well-organized women's movement in India. So these are issues that people have fought for a long time. The women's movement has been very active for a very long time in India, including during the movement for independence in India. The number of highly educated and skilled professional women in India is growing dramatically everywhere in urban India, I would say. So we have a very, very large and well-educated Indian, population of Indian women. Women become, for example, I think of STEM fields, I think of engineering, where, for example, countries like India, like Canada, like Finland, they've really struggled to bring their numbers of female engineers. In Canada, currently, we have a campaign. It's called 30 by 30, meaning that by the year 2030, we hope to have 30% of engineers will be women, essentially, in Canada. Now, Finland has never had more than 19 or 20% of its engineering base be women. Now, those numbers, in many cases, India has exceeded a long time ago because women become engineers in very large numbers in India, for example. So we have very highly educated and skilled professional women. We do have dramatic inequality at the same time. So if you look at the population pyramid, which I have based on gender, you can see that we have the phenomenon of what is called missing women because boys are, in many parts of India, are preferred socially to the extent that people will actually terminate pregnancies if they know that they're going to be having girls. We also see, a lot of kind of like the well-being of girls being affected by, for example, issues of food security within the family where girls are discriminated against. So we have both simultaneously, and that's the point I really want to make, that we have everything about women's status in India. You can say something about one part of India, it's completely opposite in another part of India. India, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, and Pakistan have all had female heads of state, many cases long before other parts of the world. So, for example, Sri Lanka, Sirimavo Bandaranaike became Sri Lanka's first female prime minister all the way back in 1960. Now, mind you, in 1960, the United States still had racial segregation, right? Never mind. I mean, we've never been, the US has never been able to have a female president. We know that only too well. Canada had one female prime minister for all of 6 months, and this is in its entire history. So when we look at countries like India, we look at Indira Gandhi in 1966 becoming the prime minister of India. So there has been very high levels of political achievement among women in Asia broadly, and I would say in South Asia more specifically. Benazir Bhutto was Pakistan's prime minister. The first time she became prime minister, she was all of 35 years old, so very young. Even by today's norms, I know that you have a very young leader in Finland at the moment, but I still think that Benazir Bhutto was exceptional for her time as well. So you get exactly that diversity when you look at female literacy rates across India. For example, if you look at the states of Mizoram in northeast India, if you look at the green in the northeast of India, and then you look at green in Kerala and in southern India. Now, Manipur, Mizoram, for example, has 100% female literacy. Every single woman in the state is literate. Kerala has very close to 100% literacy, right? Where there are other parts of the country where you still see large swaths of the country where you have between 51 to 60%. Which is really quite heartbreaking in 2019, right? So we're talking about very diverse levels of education and literacy among women in India. So definitely not one story of oppression or marginalization. This is a very interesting fact. In 2007, India became the first country to deploy an all-women contingent to a UN peacekeeping mission. This formed police unit in Liberia provided, they worked in basically also interesting because Liberia was also the first African country to have a female president, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. And India, you know, the Indian contingent served in Liberia and got actually rave reviews for their performance there, for how well they worked and how professional they were in their operations. And since then, many countries, based on the Indian model, have started all-female peacekeeping contingents and that are often deployed to conflict, you know, places that have experienced conflict and often places where there has been a systematic evidence of sexual violence against women, for example. And they've been found to be very effective in that regard. So definitely India led the charge in that regard of women in peacekeeping. So moving on, I think I'm getting close to the end of my lecture. I just wanted to say that a brief note on the arts and soft power. I think that the arts does a lot for India. I think that the global popularity of, for example, Bollywood, of arts in general, of provides India with a soft power that many countries don't have. And I think this is exceptional because yes, there is hard power. You can be a military power and, you know, whether or not we like it, countries choose that route. But I think soft power is more effective because soft power endears you to a country, endears you to a culture. And I think that is more important than hard power, where you basically are, you know, hard power basically means that you have one country's military might oppressing another, right? So I think the soft power is very important for India. And I do think that it is something that doesn't get talked about often enough. You know, I don't know how many people you recognize. You have, you know, Meera Nair, you have M. Night Shyamalan, again, people in the diaspora, diasporic Indians, the author Jhumpa Lahiri, of course, Fareed Zakaria, you have the CEO of Pepsi, Indra Nooyi, is Indian. So there are diasporic Indians who are increasingly very well recognized, very well loved for their art, for their contributions. And I think that does a lot for India. It's important to remember that, keep that in context. Finally, you know, the global popularity of Indian food, fashion, and music, it can hardly be underestimated. We have, I remember a few years ago, I would say maybe 10 or 15 years ago in the UK, they asked, you know, the English were asked what which dish most defines Britain, and they chose chicken tikka masala, which of course made me laugh because it's not at all a British meal. But I would say that, you know, definitely Indian food is probably the best part of British cuisine at this point. So it's very interesting to watch this kind of global popularity of Indian literature. For example, Amitav Ghosh's work on being able to talk about climate change in fiction. You know, he's it's a genre that is so necessary for our time, and I think India has played a very big role in that kind of in deploying its soft power in ways that people recognize and in ways that people love and respect and admire. So that brings me to the end of my lecture. I've been talking for almost an hour, for actually an hour and 18 seconds. So I'll close with a quote that I love about India, about contemporary India. Joan Robinson was a British economist who said, whatever you can rightly say about India, the opposite is also true. So that's what I've tried to do with this lecture. I've chosen very selective tropes, admittedly. I've chosen very selective things that people ask about India, you know. And I've tried to give you some information that shows you how complicated actually those tropes are. So thank you very much for listening to me. Thank you for your interest in India. Please feel free to reach out to me. You can find me very easily on email. I'm very happy to answer any questions you have. Thank you for listening. Thank you for your time. Goodbye.